Andrew mentioned my name, and then there was a pause before he described me. I was on tenterhooks. But probably not as much as the people of Israel when the Egyptians came chasing after them. We're very privileged this morning to gather together to hear God speaking to us through his word. And that story in Exodus chapter 14 is just sensational. What a story. But it's a story that's picked up in the New Testament, and that's where we're starting from this morning. If you turn to page 1008 in the Church Bible, those of you who are here regularly might know that when I preach, I'm preaching through this chapter of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 11. We've reached verse 29, just three verses this morning, and they start with that Exodus 14 story. So Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land. But the Egyptians, when they tried to do the same, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. And we're going to look back at those Old Testament stories and see what God has to say to us this morning. But first, a couple of questions that quite fit in with what Andrew was doing on the board there. Preconceived ideas. What will the next bank holiday weather be like? Oh, it'll rain as normal, won't it? I couldn't believe it when I saw the weather forecast on one of the main channels before the last bank holiday. What's the weather going to be like? Oh, it's going to be normal, rainy, wet, gloomy. Hang on a minute. What about the bank holiday before? 26 degrees! Preconceived ideas. Bank holiday weather is terrible. Later in the summer, some of you are going to go out, or perhaps you won't, onto Highbury Fields. If we go out and we put that thing up and we ask them questions about death, everyone's just going to think we're weirdos. Preconceived idea. So-and-so, maybe you couldn't possibly become a Christian. What would God want with you? And that sort of pessimistic doom and gloom approach is very often the attitude we have. Some of us never see a dark cloud in the sky. Maybe we need to adjust as well. But many of us, we always see the bad side. We can be so conditioned by what we take to be normal, what we're used to, what we expect, or what we've come to expect. And the Bible challenges us not to be like that, not to have those wrong preconceived ideas. And what these verses in Hebrews this morning do is teach us biblical thinking. So let's see if we can get that into our head. This morning, God is challenging us through the letter to the Hebrews to embrace what we might think is unlikely and to embrace it by faith in him. Now, I've said that we've been working through Hebrews chapter 11. You know what happens on all the good dramas on, Netflix particularly these days. Previously on this program, and there's a quick flashback to the story so far. This letter was written to persuade early Christians that they didn't need to go back to Old Testament rituals, the ritual of sacrifice and so on, because Jesus had fulfilled them all. And there's a wonderful explanation earlier in the letter of how that is true. The Old Testament was not the real deal. It was pointing to Jesus, and Jesus has come. And that's fantastic. But for those early Christians reading the letter, it wasn't quite so fantastic in everyday life because they were under pressure for all sorts of reasons, and in particular because there would be persecution. They were going to have to face troubles. And the writer is writing in particular to give them confidence in Jesus and to keep going, not to give up. Jesus brings you to God. Hold on to that faith because God is faithful and keep going. And that's a message that I think we might need this morning. When we get to chapter 11 of Hebrews, the writer is encouraging these believers to take heart from Old Testament stories. It's not that the Old Testament is useless. It has a huge amount to teach us. And as we've looked through this chapter, we've seen that faith is about not seeing. If you can see something, you don't need to believe in it. It's there. But faith is about what you can't see. We've seen that faith commends us to God. Faith pleases God. As we trust Him, God is pleased. Isn't that encouragement to believe? You can please God by trusting Him. We've seen that faith needs to face the unknown. Faith needs to face the future. Faith needs to face the impossible. We've seen the writer encouraging us to have faith and not to be afraid. And all of those themes are blended into these three little incidents that are described in Hebrews 11, 29 to 31. This theme this morning that I want to take of unlikely faith. Now you need to turn back to Exodus chapter 14. We'll start off, we'll look at each of these incidents that the writer to Hebrews uses and pick out what we can learn from them. So Exodus 14, page 56 in your Bible. The writer to Hebrews simply tells that story in one sentence. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. It must have been a really daunting prospect for those many, many, Andrew mentioned possibly 2 million Israelites, having come out of Egypt, there with the sea at their backs, but facing them, the Egyptian army. Or perhaps they were facing the sea and the Egyptian army was coming up behind them. Not sure, you'll have to read through and work it out for yourself. But what a problem between the Egyptians and the deep, well, not the deep blue sea, between the Egyptians and the Red Sea. And it was completely natural for them to be daunted by the situation they were in. A great army is chasing after them and they've got nowhere to go. And the Israelites, as you know, if you know your Old Testament, at this period of history, were pretty good at grumbling and complaining when things didn't look good. And so they grumbled and they complained. Weren't there any graves in Egypt we could have died in? Why have we come out here? Simply to meet our doom, they say. And in verses 13 and 14 of Exodus 14, Moses speaks to them and gives them a promise, if you like. Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. Nothing for you to do. Trust God. He'll sort the Egyptians out. What a fantastic promise. But I imagine there were 2 million Israelites thinking, well, how's he going to do that then? Because it's hopeless, isn't it? Well, we read into verse 15 and Moses hears from God exactly how God will do it. I will make sure that you and your people can walk across the sea. There will be dry land for you. Not so the Egyptians. And so Moses obeys God. Verse 21, he holds his hand over the sea, stretches it out. And God divides the sea, drives the sea back by a strong wind. And there are walls of water creating a corridor across the sea with dry land for the people to walk through. And yet, if you or I were there, I'm pretty sure we'd still be daunted. Yeah, it looks great. Fantastic. Put a foot onto that dry ground. Okay, put 2 feet on. But when you've got 500 yards down, what's going to happen to that water? Is it going to stay like that? It's not an everyday sort of event. What if it doesn't stay like that? What if the wind stops? What does the writer to Hebrews say? By faith, the people crossed. And faith was well founded. Because as we read on in the stories we heard earlier on, the Israelites do walk across that dry ground and they do all reach the other side. And then there's this tremendous contrast with the Egyptians who try to do the same thing and don't succeed because the Lord works against them and eventually brings the waters crashing down on them. They are destroyed. Faith in God was well founded, was well placed. And I want to encourage you this morning that if you are ever in a situation in your life, perhaps even now, when you can't see a way out as a believer, faith is always possible because God is great. I can give you a very simple biblical example of that from somewhere else. Think about that story of Daniel. And do you remember the time when three of his friends refused to bow down to the king? And they're in big trouble because if you refuse to bow down to the king, well, you're going to be thrown into a fiery furnace. And the king, Nebuchadnezzar, is told that these three men have not done what he's ordered. And they're brought before him. And he says to them, if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Devil in the deep blue sea, well, king and a furnace. And to avoid the furnace, I have to disobey God. Can't do it, say Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter, don't you? If this be so, if you throw us into the furnace, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. We can't do it because we obey our gods, and our God is able to save us from this impossible situation. And, as you know, the story turns out, our God does save them from that impossible situation. This is the story of the Bible in many ways. What about you? What's the situation in which you can't see a way out? Maybe you're under pressure at work, for example. Maybe you've made a mess of something. Or maybe somebody else has made a mess of something, but in order to sort it out, you're going to have to cover it up dishonestly somehow. Or else there could be disastrous consequences for you, for your business, for your employers. I'm going to have to tell a lie. My conscience isn't comfortable with that, but what else can I do? I'm in an impossible situation. Except that we're told very clearly by Paul in writing to the Corinthians, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. Under pressure to sin? Well, maybe take a lesson from those three men facing the fiery furnace. They were under pressure to sin, to worship a king who was not God. They resisted that pressure. There didn't seem to be a way out. But God himself came and stood with them in that furnace. The promise of Corinthians is that God will stand with you in your temptation as you look to resist it and be faithful to God. God will be faithful to you. Maybe your circumstances are so pressurized in one way or another that you are weary. Yes, you're a Christian, but it's just too hard. And this situation or that situation will never change. What's the use of carrying on as a Christian? It's not doing me any good. It's not that I don't believe, but I just can't keep going. If you're tempted to give up on God, then just remember what happened to Israel. And remember the song they sang afterwards. Have a look into chapter 15 and verse 11 in particular. Again, surely this is the message of the Bible that brings glory to God and encouragement to our hearts. Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? Hold on, says the writer to the Hebrews. Hold on to the reality, the truth, that this is your God. Believe in him and wait for his time and his salvation. In your circumstances, now, hold on to the truth about God. Back in Hebrews, we are pointed to a second Old Testament story in these verses. For that, you need to turn to Joshua chapter 6. And you'll find that on page 181, if you have a church Bible. The writer to Hebrews says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. History has moved on from where we were just now in Exodus. After 40 years of wandering through the wilderness on the other side of the Red Sea, Joshua has become the leader of Israel, and God has commanded Joshua to take the people into the promised land. They've crossed the River Jordan. And they face now the first city that stands in the way of their taking the land for themselves as God has promised to them. If the situation facing Israel by the Red Sea was a daunting prospect, what happens with Israel facing Jericho is that God presents them with a rather bizarre method of attacking the city. But our writer tells us that by faith, the walls of Jericho fell. How did that happen? Well, there's the problem, the city, fortified city. If Israel is to fulfill its destiny, God-given, of conquering the land, what are they going to do? Now, it was natural to ask the question. The obvious thing is to try to fight the people of Jericho somehow, but they've got these walls around them. Perhaps the next obvious logical thing to do would have been just to camp round the city and starve them out. Don't know how practical that was. Maybe lots of the Israelites were tempted to move on. Well, let's not worry about Jericho, let's bypass it, let's see if we can find somewhere a bit easier. But as well as the general command to Joshua to go into the land, I will be with you, this land will be yours, God gives Joshua a very specific command, a very specific instruction about what to do with Jericho. And if you scan through Joshua chapter 6, the first part, you'll see that the method that God gives to this army of Israel was, well, bizarre is the only way to describe it, surely. March round the city, Joshua 6, verse 3. All the men of war going round the city. Women and children, you can just sit back. Not because there's going to be any fighting. You could walk around the city, but it's the men of war who are to do it, with priests, with ram's horns blowing the trumpets. And each day I want you to walk around that city once. On the seventh day, you're to march around the city 7 times. And the priests are to blow the trumpets. And when there's a long blast with a ram's horn, verse 5, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, then all the people shall shout with a great shout. Now, I'm pretty sure you could read any book that has ever been written on the art of warfare, and that wouldn't be a suggested method. But that's what God tells Israel to do. And you can imagine them quite reasonably thinking, seriously? If we are going to fight them, well, let's at least fight them somehow. But just marching around, blowing trumpet and shouting. Waste of time. We're going to look pretty stupid, aren't we? With our swords and stuff, just marching around shouting. But what does the writer to Hebrews say? By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. If you read on in Joshua chapter 6 from verse 8, the people do exactly what God has commanded them to by faith. And the conclusion, well, we find that in verse 20. The people shouted, the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. Faith in God was entirely justified. Now, that bizarre method challenges us. We think we know how to do things. God often tells us to do things differently. I think of our church situation down in the West End. You know, we used to meet on Sundays in the London City Mission premises at Neal Street. And you know there was a plan for the mission to hand it over to some other Christian organisation. And in preparation for that, the premises were closed at the end of August last year, and they're still closed, and there's a legal delay, and it looks like it'll be a while longer before we get back to have a meeting place. We're thinking it may not be to the end of the year. We don't know that for sure, but it's drifted out a long time already. But we need a meeting place. Everybody knows that. You can't have a church without a place that everybody can come to. Even if they don't come, you need to have a place. And yet we haven't got it. And we've been praying to God for it. And surely he hears and answers our prayers. And so it may well be that God is speaking to us and telling us, you're putting too much weight on this meeting place at the moment. For the time being, I want you to think more about getting to grips with individual people. People you know. People you can contact through door-to-door work, and don't just depend on getting them to a meeting place. Do with them what you can, where they are, in your homes, in a coffee shop. You don't have to have a meeting place. Perhaps we need to be taught to free our minds from that. Oh, a meeting place is a good thing to have, isn't it? And we believe that we will have one in the long run. But for the time being, God is pointing us, it seems, in a different direction. His way, not our way. So what about you? Is God holding you back from success in your life, from what you think you should be doing or what you want to achieve? Are your plans not working out in some way? If that's the case, then maybe you need to remember that faith does it God's way. That counters the spirit of the age. It counters the spirit of our own hearts. I did it my way is the most popular song for a funeral, I think. The world has its way of doing things. We can so easily be affected by that culture. But the Bible tells us that there are wrong ways to fulfill even good desires. And sometimes when we pursue those wrong ways, God will put a block on our success in order to point us to his way of doing things. We were talking at the book group on Friday evening, and Femi mentioned a situation of somebody who was desperate to have children. Clock ticking. Hasn't been able to find the right man. What do you do? And in the world today, there are various options you can take up to get round that problem, to try and deal with it. And yet the Bible is very clear that God's design for men and women is for marriage and family to come from that basis. And if you can't find a husband, then other things have to go on hold. God's way. There are all sorts of examples in the modern world of situations like that. There's nothing wrong with wanting a child, is there? That's a God-given design. But desire, but in this world, it doesn't always work out because the world has been spoiled from God's original design. We can't put it right ourselves. We need to think about what God has to say to us. We sometimes do that in Christian work, in Christian witness, in evangelism. What will work? Well, whatever we're doing now isn't working very well. So, well, we need to be more glossy in our presentation. We need to have more fun. We need to get people in. What do they want? Does that work? Well, you might get more numbers into a church. But God's very clear that his way of bringing people to faith in Jesus is through the foolish message of the cross. And yes, there are questions about how we communicate that message, but there's no choice about the message. You're a sinner. You need to be saved. Jesus, God, came into the world to die to save us. Without him, there's no hope in the judgment. If we try anything else, then it's not going to succeed in the long run, but faith follows God's way. There's a verse in Isaiah that helps us to pin this together, really. Isaiah chapter 55, verses 8 and 9. This is the faith that we need to have this morning. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts. Neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so my ways are higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. And we need to humble ourselves to remember that and to continue to trust God. So that's the first two stories in Hebrews 11. What's the last one? Verse 31, by faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Now this is the end of the story of Joshua chapter 6, but the story begins in Joshua chapter 2. If we've had a daunting prospect facing those Israelites at the Red Sea with the Egyptians chasing them, we've had a bizarre method for carrying out God's will, we now come to a very unlikely person to be part of God's purposes. But what we read is that whereas, if you like, the walls of Jericho fell by faith, Rahab did not fall by faith. Her problem is that she was not an Israelite. She belonged to the city of Jericho. She was a Gentile, a foreigner. She was the enemy. And there she is in that city. And she knows the Israelites have arrived. The whole city knows the Israelites are around. And actually, they're pretty scared. They're afraid of the impact of the Israelites on them. Joshua 2 tells us that very clearly. Rahab says to the Israelites who come spying, our hearts melted. There was no spirit left in any man. We were scared, terrified. But when these Israelite spies turn up and lodge with her, Rahab has a real problem. They are the enemy. And what will my neighbours think? And what will they think of me, these two men who've come looking secretly? Not only am I from Jericho, a Gentile, a foreigner, outside of God's people, I'm a woman, which doesn't give me much status. I'm a prostitute. And yet, this unlikely woman believes in the God of Israel. What does Rahab say in Joshua 2:11? The Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. She's heard about what has happened. What has, and she says, it's not the Israelites that have done it. It's your God, Yahweh. And I recognize that and I believe it. And the only hope I have is if you will help me. So when these two men come, the story is, look, I'll keep you safe if you'll keep me safe. And they do a deal. You keep us safe, and we will look after you. Joshua 2, verse 18. When we come into the land, you shall tie this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. They had to escape from the city, from Rahab's house, through a window in the wall. Tie this scarlet cord in the window, and you shall gather into your house your father and mother, your brothers, and all your father's household. If anyone goes out of doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be guiltless. But if a hand is laid on anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head. You do what we say, and we will look after you. That's a great promise. But surely it would be natural for Rahab, once these spies have disappeared, to wonder, is this really going to happen? Is this likely? Oh, they told me that, but will they keep their word? Well, the writer to Hebrews tells us that by faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient. That explains why the people of Jericho were put to the sword. They were enemies of God. But if you turn to Joshua chapter 6 and continue from where we were looking at just a moment ago, you'll discover that those two spies did keep their word, that Joshua insisted that Rahab and her family should be safe. The scarlet cord worked. The scarlet cord, keeping somebody safe. Go back a little while. Do you remember when the red blood of the lamb on the doorpost kept Israel safe? When the destroyer passed over the land of Egypt and took the firstborn of every family that was unprotected. Fast forward to the precious red blood of Jesus that saves his people from their sins. Rahab, a Gentile woman, prostitute, the enemy, has faith in Yahweh, the God of Israel, the one true living God, and is saved. And we shouldn't be surprised about that. How can God possibly want, fill in the name, it might even be yourself. And yet that's exactly what God does. I was thinking of examples of people of whom that could be said. So unlikely. There's a book written fairly recently, in the last few years, called The Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. Written by a woman who was a lesbian professor of English in the States, an activist, a campaigner against God, against his created world, his design for the world that he's made. And yet God met with her through the love of his people and through the message of the foolishness of the cross, and she came to believe in Jesus. Go back in history, think of somebody like John Newton, that hymn, Amazing Grace. How his life showed the amazing grace of God. A sort of a rebel, a runaway, I'm going to do my own thing. Caught up in the Navy, press ganged actually, back in the 18th century, I think. And living a pretty pagan life. Didn't believe. He was known apparently as the great blasphemer. In a day when blasphemy meant something. John Newton was really anti-God. He was involved in the slave trade, then actually he became a slave himself. But God put his hand on John Newton's life. And he was transformed by the grace of God, by the message of the foolishness of the cross. And he became a great preacher, hymn writer, a great servant of God. God takes unlikely people and saves them. Does that happen still today? Well, Rosaria Butterfield, the professor I mentioned, was just a few years ago. You see John Moore 20 years ago, 15 years ago maybe. You would have thought, not a hope in hell. of John Moore becoming a Christian. Ask him afterwards about his life. And yet God dealt with him, an unlikely convert. Why should we be surprised? Because faith is for whoever. We've read the Gospels, haven't we? Jesus came for the sick, not people who thought they were healthy. Jesus came for sinners. The most well-known verse in the Bible, John 3, verse 16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life." A little later on, John 6, verse 35, Jesus says, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. Whoever comes to me, I will not cast out." Is that you this morning? Is that somebody you care about? The God of Hebrews chapter 11 is the God who saves people who are unlikely. God can bring you or them to share in Rahab's faith. So, three little verses in the New Testament, a whole wealth of illustration from the Old Testament, showing us that unlikely faith knocks out our preconceived ideas about who God is, about what he can do in our lives. And that's the challenge. The faith of the Old Testament was before Jesus. The Hebrew Christians who received that letter, well, they knew all about Jesus. They could hold on to him in the same way that we can. And that's where the writer is taking us. Just come forward into chapter 12 of Hebrews. "Since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Jesus is the one who's died to save us. Jesus is the one who lives to reign. And we're to take encouragement from that here and now. Yes, we may be struggling. Yes, we may suffer. Yes, it may be tough. But hold on to that faith, because he's coming, and one day we will reign with him. May God help us to live this week with that biblical thinking continuously in our hearts and our minds.